Yeah, I wouldn't so much. I would appreciate the joke and the truth. Honorable Vulnich?
Honorable Chair, I'd just like to indicate to the House that I'm going to have to leave at 4 o'clock today, and I do apologize in advance.
Okay. I don't think there's a problem in that. Honorable Jay, is this your call to release this? Well, thank you, Honorable Members and guests, because it's our first interaction with you. What we'll do, we'll make some introduction, and we are the new portfolio committee on health in the fifth administration, and our brief is not about prescriptions. The people think that health is all about prescription and 2 tablets straight out of the day when you have pain. Our brief is that why to ensure that we assist in the changing of the challenges, in addressing the challenges at come with programs and the implementation of the programs on the bedding, on the 3 areas of the tropical disease in our country, which you are one of the entities of the Department of Health. So together we have got that challenge. What we will do in the introduction, we will start with the honorable members, but I will start with myself. I'm the chairperson of the, my name is Lindelof. My surname is Dunjua. I've been given the responsibility to chair this program of Congress. That I've finished the Congress. On the Virgin Port Elizabeth. Next to me on my left is Vilokazi Machalamba. She's not new maybe to some of you. She's the secretary of the portfolio committee. On the extreme right, it's Linda Hushe, the content advisor, and the handsome young man at the back, whom I'm always having a challenge in pronouncing her name. His name is Zube. Yes. I will then give the honorable members time to introduce themselves, starting on my right.
I'm Marcella. I'm the member of this committee.
Itumela Mosala from the ANC.
Who is such a from the DA?
And you're coming for DA?
Bomber James, a member of this committee from the DA.
I'm
Frank
Mokwa from the
Department
of Health.
Mr. Tim Shwana from the Department of Health.
Kanvin Pillay, Department of Health.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'm Dan Lefuchel from the Council for the Vaccines. I'm the CFO and currently the ex-chair.
Good afternoon. My name is Tabukho Mazia, the Head of Financial Supervision at the Council for the Customs.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Craig Wittenberg, I'm Head of Legal Services at the Council for Medical Systems.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Anton de Valliers. I'm Head of Research and Monitoring at Council for Medical Systems.
Good afternoon. My name is Trevor Bailey. I'm the Deputy Chairperson of the Council.
Good afternoon. My name is Karim Hussain. I'm a member of council and chair of the finance committee.
We have got was the one here when you were introducing yourself? Can you please say?
I'm Dominic Rivera, head of clinic.
I'm Olusha from Energy.
Hi, I'm Tamar Khan from Business Day.
Thank you very much. I don't know who's going to do the presentation. It's over to you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I would just like to make some introductory remarks, and I'd like to begin by just formally apologising on behalf of Professor Yusuf Viriava, who is the chairperson of the council. Unfortunately, he's not able to be here today. He is out of the country in Botswana teaching, and he then just formally requested that his apologies be noted. As a result of that, as the deputy chairperson, I will be filling in for Professor Viriava. Madam Chair, I would like to start off the presentation today by dealing with a matter that has been in the public domain. And it relates to the allegations that have appeared in the press and are of public knowledge. And that really relates to the suspension of the registrar of the Council for Medical Schemes, Dr. Gunshaw. As I've indicated, it is a matter of public record that there were some allegations made against Dr. Gunshaw in court papers in relation to what he should simply describe as being the Mitchell matter. Those allegations were very, very serious. They were made under oath on affidavit. Clearly, both the Minister, Honourable Minister of Health, and the Council could not ignore these allegations. The registrar, Dr. Gunshaw, in turn, also requested that that these allegations against him be investigated. And it was common cause between the Council and the Minister that an investigation should occur. As a consequence of that, in consultation with the Honourable Minister, the Council formed a task team made up of members of the Council and of the Minister's office. Terms of reference were drawn up, and as a consequence of that, Edward Nathan Sonnenberg, who described themselves as the largest law firm in Africa, have been instructed to conduct an investigation into the allegations. The registrar went on ordinary leave while the Honourable Minister considered whether or not Dr. Gunshaw, the registrar, should be suspended. As a consequence of that legal procedure that was necessary, the Honourable Minister then proceeded to suspend Dr. Gunter. In Dr. Gunter's place, the Minister has appointed Mr. Daniel Ochoa as the Chief Financial Officer. He is now also the Acting Registrar and Chief Executive Officer of the Council for Medical Schemes. The investigation is underway. It is continuing. We have expressed in the strongest possible terms to Edward Nathan Sonnenberg that the investigation be concluded as quickly as is possible. The investigation is not yet complete. We currently await the outcome of the report. We believe that it is in the best interests of Dr. Gunshaw, of the Council, of the Minister, of Medical Schemes, of members of Medical Schemes, that that the investigation be considered to be free and fair and legitimate. Clearly, due process must be followed. We're conscious of the time that the matter is taking, but at the end of the day, what we need to ensure is that there is a full, impartial investigation into these allegations, and we are currently allowing that process to unfold. We will obviously await the outcome of the investigation, and only once we have that information in front of us will we then be able to take the next step in the matter. and we throw that in turn to the members of the committee that this matter has been out in the public domain, and that we needed to deal with this matter up front to ensure the members of this committee and the public at large that the Council for Medical Schemes, in conjunction with the Minister, will do the right thing for the right reason at the right time. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much. I think that was for... I don't think we are expecting a correspondent, but it's just to take us through on what is a subject of which is public knowledge.
Yes.
Yes,
indeed, Madam Chair, what we didn't want to do was to allow this matter to, in fact, cast some darkness on the very, very good work that the Council is doing and the message that we, in fact, want to deliver to this portfolio committee in terms of its oversight role. That being the case, Madam Chair, I would like to hand over to the to the acting chairperson and acting registrar of the council, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think in terms of our presentation, we are going to be giving each other a chance as the four delegates, the four functionaries in the council. My colleagues will be presenting on different aspects of this presentation, and I think we made it easy after each. The ending of each presentation, the name of the certain appears, so that we could follow as we do. But the first slide that contains the structure of our presentation, we're going to take you through our legislative mandate, and we're also going to do an industry analysis so that you're well aware that what's happening, and we also be took into our budget. And I think, Madam Chair, we also appreciate the fact that you are a new committee after the election, so we'll try to explain to you clearly what is our function and our role in the whole industry. But in terms of the legislative mandate, Madam Chair, is that we are established in terms of the Medical Schemes Act, Act No. 131 of 1998. And I think the role of the Council, the functions are contained in Section 7, which in the main talks to the protection of members, the protection of the beneficiaries, and
would appreciate if you can talk to them too. Or do you have a problem?
No.
Sure? How do we end up with
the slides?
Yeah, it's going to be easier. Yeah, if you
go slash your menu. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I was just outlining the legislative framework within which we operate, and I indicated that we operate in terms of the Medical Schemes Act, Act No. 131 of 1998, and the section that confers the mandate of this council is Section 7, which clearly points out that we protect the interests of beneficiaries, and we coordinate and control the function of medical schemes. We also make recommendations to the minister on relevant matters, on a range of issues. We also investigate complaints, and in this way is our way of protecting the interests of members as well. And we approve the rules of the schemes, and we advise the minister on matters pertaining to the function of the medical aid schemes. Against that backdrop, we have got four strategic goals in the council, one being access to quality medical scheme is maximized, the cover is maximized, and our second goal deals with the governance of medical schemes, which are responsible to the environment and beneficiaries are informed and protected. I think as we go into the presentation, you will see how the governance of medical skills are undertaken in our organization. The third goal talks to our internal processes that CMS is responsive to the needs of the environment by being an efficient and effective organization. That talks to our finances, talks to our HR and our IT systems. We'll elaborate that in the next coming slides. And the fourth goal, which is the important one for this portfolio committee, that we're providing some strategic advice to the minister. And in this regard, we're aware of the health reform process that are being undertaken by the National Department of Health, the NHI. We're doing our utmost best to contribute to that health trajectory. I think this is just a graphic presentation of the four goals: access to medical aid schemes, and the governance of medical schemes, and the third one being the regulator talking to us, our internal processes, and the fourth one is just the one that I've just spoken about, our interaction with our regulatory authority, being the minister, before we give advice on a range of matters. And I think at this point in time, Antonio will take us through the first goal of our organization, being access to good quality medical aid, and I think he will elaborate going further.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our first goal is that we must try to ensure that access to good quality medical scheme cover is maximized for our beneficiaries. Now, how do we do it? We rely very much on the Medical Scheme Act 131 of 1998 and the different pillars in the Medical Scheme Act. Now, the first pillar is the one of open enrollment. Now, open enrollment is basically, this is a social security principle. Any applicant may join an open medical scheme of his or her choice, and no discrimination is allowed. So the important thing here is Section 29.1N of the Act provides that schemes may not discriminate against any member on any ground, for example, age, gender, and even health status. They are not allowed to discriminate against the beneficiaries. Now, how do schemes then protect them? Against hopping member movement from one option to another, or one scheme to another, and anti-selection through the imposing, they can basically impose waiting periods for late joiner penalties. For those members, for example, decide at the very last stage, now I'm sick, I need a medical scheme, and I'm going to join a medical scheme. The medical scheme then can impose a waiting period or a late joiner penalty on those kind of members. Now, on this pillar, we had our recent challenges, for example, the transfer of the Transmed members to the open schemes, specifically two schemes in the open scheme environment. Now, I think we're all aware that Transmed members, they're a bit old in the age group. It is a more sort of higher than average risk profile if you compare it to the average risk profile of the medical scheme. Now, two schemes challenged this transfer, obviously because of the bad risk, and there was a complaint lodged by an individual member, and the appeals board ruled in favor of that individual member, and since the ruling, one of the two schemes then agreed that they will accept all those members of Transmed that would like to join a specific scheme. So the pillar in the act really helped us to overcome the challenges. Then there's another challenge where schemes refused to enroll members following the termination of membership due to non-disclosure. Now that was a very interesting one on the non-disclosure. Again, there was one scheme arguing refusing to enroll these members as they said that they have defrauded the scheme and that they have defrauded the scheme, and if they are forced to re-allow them on the scheme, there is no incentive for members to be honest when they're filling in the application forms. Obviously, the pillar again, the members are protected. You cannot deny the membership. What the scheme can do is they can impose a condition-specific waiting period. That is our first pillar of open enrollment social security principle. The next very important one is the one of community rating. Now, the community rating is all about fairness of contributions. Everybody working the same benefit option will pay exactly the same contribution amount. You cannot discriminate in a benefit option. Everybody pays the same. The only way you can differentiate is in terms of the family size or number of dependents and maybe income. Medical schemes are not allowed to risk rate. They're not allowed, unlike your short-term insurance or even your gap cover products, they're not allowed to risk rate. Section 29(1)(n) also makes it very clear contributions may not be based on any discriminatory grounds, past or present state of health, or on the frequency or rendering of relevant services. The next very important pillar and a hot topic, I suppose, is the prescribed minimum benefits, so-called PMBs. PMBs is a set of defined benefits, and it is exactly the same from benefit option to benefit option. Remember, within the schemes you get got benefit options, and within every benefit option, approximately 300 benefit options in the medical scheme industry, there's that set of benefits that is exactly the same. It is roughly the 270 diagnosis and treatment pairs, plus your 25 chronic conditions and emergencies, and also HIV is also part of those chronic conditions. PMBs must be funded in full. In other words, the charge amount, what the actual provider charge, the schemes must pay it in full. Now yes, schemes have a number of ways to manage these costs, and one of them is designated service providers, formularies, protocols, basically your managed care part, but I will come back to that in a later slide. Yes, we also had a recent challenge on the payment of PMBs in full, the case of BHF, the Board of Healthcare Funders versus the Council and the Registrar. In short, the matter in the High Court about the interpretation of Regulation 8 payment in full, the court found that BHF did not have legal standing in a court and should have joined the other medical schemes. A petition to appeal was lodged, but it was unsuccessful. Now, the pillars of the medical schemes are just what I'd like to change the first two bullets. The four very important ones is the reporting requirements. It is very comprehensive, and my colleague Craig will take you through the governance structures, and the book will take you through the non-healthcare costs. But the non-governance structures is basically the glue that puts everything together and holds everything together. And then obviously the non-healthcare costs, I think our objective is to make sure that we maximize the benefits, healthcare benefits being paid to our members instead of the administration costs. Medical schemes are for non-profit. They cannot make profit, although the administrator companies, the companies who are actually paying the schemes, they can make profit in the current regulatory framework. Now, if medical schemes are not protected, the public health system could be flooded with patients who usually make use of the private system. The right to healthcare needs to be protected. That's very important, and I think also for financial soundness and governance, we need a very strong regulatory framework. Next slide. Okay, taking that you back to the PMBs, I think this is a burning question to everybody when we discuss the PMBs. Now, the estimated cost per month for 2013 was 508.20 per beneficiary per month. That was an estimate of data that was used of data of 2009. Since then, we received actual payments that was paid out for 2013. And the actual reserved amount paid out is 512 rand per beneficiary per month. Now that is not cheap, but at least if you look at the risk benefits being paid out, then PMBs make up 53% of all the risk benefits being paid out. That is for the 270 ETPs plus emergencies plus the chronics. And 53% is PMBs. The remaining 47% paid out of the risk rules are for non-PMBs. So it is not the case that all benefits being paid out is for PMBs and nobody can afford it, although the trend is a concern, and we need to look at the trend, see how we can make healthcare in the private industry more affordable. Our principles to manage financial risk. As I said, schemes can contract with designated service providers. Designated service providers it is a group of a scheme set up. There's a contract between a medical scheme and a service provider or a group of service providers. Now, if a member then use service provider outside that designated group, then the scheme may impose a co-payment on that member. Of course, the objective is from designated service providers, one of the objectives is to minimize the cost. So if you go outside the designated service provider, it's possible that you can end up with a component. The next is the managed care principles. Now, the managed care principles is also very important. When a formula is dropped, it's clinically appropriate and effective, and a beneficiary knowingly declines and opt to use another drug instead of the scheme, then the scheme, approved by a scheme, then the scheme also can apply a co-payment. Now the next slide, I'm just going to touch you through what we've been doing with managed care in the council. Managed care is very important to look at the cost from a managed care perspective, but not only cost. We need to look at the quality and we need to look at the assets. So the burning question is, what is the value proposition for our members or our beneficiaries? Now, value in simple terms is defined as quality divided by cost. The higher your quality and the lower the cost, the higher will your value be. Now, we're in a process with the industry, and what we've realized is that we as council, the regulator, we need to take the lead and start with the industry to define your so-called process indicators, what the managed care provider was supposed to do, your outcomes, a simple example of outcomes, if you're in a managed care program, they're supposed to measure your CD4 count at diagnosis, and then after 6 months and after 12 months. If the program is working, then one would expect to see an improvement in the CD4 count. Then we also said to them that you need to collect certain data, minimum data. Otherwise, it is very difficult to demonstrate the value of your managed care program. So we started this process and we finished with HIV, and we've decided, if we look at the bulk of the cost in the industry, the bulk of the cost has been paid to hospitals, medical specialists, and to medicines. And we said we need to focus, we asked ourselves and the industry, where must we focus? And we said that, looked at the least managed care programs, they were designed. One of the objectives when they were designed was to keep the patient out of the hospital. Now, are these disease managed programs, are they really effective? So we're building with that process, and that is why we started with the CDLs, all the disease managed care programs on the CDLs, to specify the process indicators, the outcomes, and then the minimum data spec. And then it is up to the managed care entity to demonstrate to the council the value proposition. And we will only credit them if they are able to demonstrate to us the value that they add, so that our beneficiaries, that they get value for money. Now, the revision of the PVs, in 2010, we made a submission to the Department of Health on the revision of the PV regulations. In April 2014, we received feedback from the Department of Health. And to make a long story a short story, the message is we need to look at the PMP package and we need to revise the package. And the message from the minister was that we need to look at the preventative and the primary care component and expand the current PMP package on those areas. But obviously, if you're going to expand, you need to consider cost. We're busy with the Department of Health on the revision of the PMP package. Affordability of healthcare. Now, cost, I've touched on the cost. On the PMP cost, 508 rand or 512 rand per beneficiary per month. It is not cheap. But I think the PMP was never designed to operate in an environment where there's no price regulation. And that is one of the things that we seriously need to look at. It is a price regulation mechanism to bring back into the private medical scheme industry.
a significantly larger proportion of benefits is being paid towards the PMBs because the providers or the schemes, they must pay a PMB in full. It is sort of an open checkbook if there's no privacy regulation. So we really need to look at it. Yes, there are methods that schemes can implement to save costs, but I think it is an unfair situation that is currently going on where schemes are paying PMBs in full without any price regulation. Then the gap cover products, there's evidence that also drives up the professional fees. And one also needs to ask the question on gap cover products, why do they exist? They exist because of affordability of healthcare. Roughly 18% of the child's amount by providers is being paid out of pocket by our beneficiaries. And that 18%, it is a complex calculation, but that 18% is probably a lower limit of what is being paid out of pocket by the beneficiaries in the private medical scheme industry. There's a tax credit system, I think it came into place in 2012, basically just make the playing field more fair for all taxpayers irrespective of your income. And as I said, affordability is, we consider it as one of the greatest obstacles to growth in the private medical scheme industry. And if we're not able to grow this industry, then the industry is going to be very difficult to see that it's going to be sustainable over time because your population will age. And there's a high correlation between age and your healthcare costs or your claims costs. So the pillars really helped us. We're very thankful for the pillars in the Medical Scheme Act, but I think we need more than that. This graph on your x-axis is all the schemes in a private medical scheme industry, and then the y-axis is the amount per beneficiary per month, your PMB cost. You can see the difference. On the left-hand side, the PMB cost varies around 320 rand up to 1,150 rand. Now that difference is the result of differences in the risk profiles of medical schemes. And we think that if we are able to put them on the same level, then we will see more efficiencies and effectiveness in the medical scheme industry. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm just going to take you through a couple of slides that show the trends in performance of medical schemes. Unfortunately, I haven't got a pointer. You can do note that this data is a bit dated because it relates to 2012. We are in the process of finalizing the latest MR report for 2013. It's almost at the printers as we speak. And so this is based on 2012 data. On this slide, what we see is a trend in number of schemes, which is represented by the blue and red bars. And the green line shows you the number of lives covered. And what one can see on this slide is that there's a generally declining trend in both open and restricted schemes over time, which is indicative of the consolidation that's been occurring in the market, particularly your small and restricted schemes, where employers are finding it more onerous to run a medical scheme in this challenging environment. And typically those members then opt to join open schemes. I think the point here is that whilst consolidation is good because currently there are probably too many schemes for the number of lives that are covered. So consolidation is good, but one needs to find that balance where we are not in a situation where there is an oligopoly or even a monopoly. The green line was pretty much flat in the area up until 2006, which obviously coincides with the time when GEM started operating. So that spike that you see is largely due to the growth in GEM. Average age of beneficiaries. The green line is all medical schemes, average age of all medical schemes, which shows that it is generally aging. The two bottom lines, the red one and the dot one, is red one is restricted schemes, including GEMs. Now, because GEMs generally has a younger average population relative to other schemes, if you exclude it,
restricted schemes would have a much higher average age as indicated by the dotted line. And the spike that you see in the red line between 2011 and 2012 is because GEMS took over a group of pensions from an open scheme, and that impacted on their average age. Total money spent by schemes, excluding savings, as you are aware, a medical scheme contribution could be structured to have a savings portion for discretionary benefits, and then the risk pool. So this just is based on the risk pool. So for every healthcare rand, 87.7% goes towards benefits, and then the balance goes 11.4% goes towards non-healthcare expenditure. This again shows you broadly the various disciplines of healthcare expenditure. And as Anton alluded, private hospitals, is where most of the money is spent of social benefits, that's at 36.7%. And so together, hospitals, medicines, and specialists account for 25% of total spend in healthcare. This is based on the same data, just the beneficiary per annum and also adjusted for inflation. So yet again, one sees the trend in private hospital, which has been upward over time, as well as specialists. And over the period indicated here, which is from 2000 to 2012, both specialists and private hospitals, the cost per beneficiary per annum has increased by more than 80% over this period. This slide shows you the trend in non-healthcare expenditure. Obviously, in the earlier years before the promulgation of the Medical Schemes Act, one saw double-digit increases in non-healthcare expenditure, which actually was higher than the increases in contributions. Over time, those costs have pretty much stabilized. This, by the way, has been adjusted for inflation. And there are various interventions provided for in the Medical Schemes Act to intervene in this area. So overall, non-healthcare expenditure has stabilized, although there are schemes that display quite high amounts of non-healthcare expenditure, and the Office of the Registrar is engaging with those schemes on an ongoing basis. Lastly, this slide just shows you overall solvency in the medical schemes industry. The blue area is what is required by the law. Regulation 9 requires all medical schemes to be at 25% of gross annual contributions. In the earlier years from 2000, the three lines representing all schemes, the red line being all, the green line is open scheme, and then the purple line is restricted schemes. One can see that in the earlier years there was a general upward trend, and those are the years when schemes still need to build up reserves to get to 25%. And many schemes have provided in their reserving policy, particularly restricted schemes, which have large amounts of reserves. They've planned to cushion the increases in contributions by using reserves. So they have lower contribution increases over time, funding it out of reserves because they've got excess reserves. So overall, the industry remains solvent. There are schemes that are in trouble, and we continue to engage with those on an ongoing basis. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Committee. I'm just briefly going to take you through some of the governance aspects relating to medical schemes, in which I'll touch on really the structure of medical schemes in terms of how they govern. I'll briefly touch on the governance structure of council currently provided for in the Medical Schemes Act, and really the responses of the Council for Medical Schemes as a regulator to some of the concerns which have arisen in the industry. Firstly, in looking at the governance framework within which medical schemes function, these are essentially provided for in Section 57 of the Medical Schemes Act, which indicates and requires that every single medical scheme must have a board of trustees of whom 50% are elected. Balance may be nominated, and the various permutations around that. But most importantly, the trustees of those medical schemes are required to be fit and proper. And so that's a very, very important requirement in terms of what we do as a regulator, because very often when the problems and the difficulties which arise
in medical schemes around this. Bear in mind that this is an industry in excess of 100 billion rands per annum. So we're talking about sizable funds which are at the disposal and which are, which these trustees are required and obliged to take care of in the best interests of the members of those schemes. So firstly, they're required to be fit and proper in terms of the election of the boards of trustees. They in turn then have an obligation to ensure that they appoint a principal officer who is equivalent really to a chief executive officer in the business sense, the set of a company, who also likewise is required to be a fit and proper person to undertake the duties and functions. And one understands why that is when one looks at, as I say, the quantums, and my colleagues here have referred to some of those percentages. Then in turn, of course, medical schemes will engage third-party service providers. Some schemes are administered internally in terms of an in-house administration arrangement which they're entitled to engage in, in terms of which they do their own administration. But I think by far the bulk of medical schemes are administered by way of third-party administrator arrangements. And I'll talk a little more to that as I continue, because it's quite important to note the influence that some of these third-party administrators can have over medical schemes and some of the concerns that we have around that. But certainly the Board of Trustees, again, sits right at the centre of the responsibility which the trustees carry in terms of their fiduciary responsibility towards the members of those schemes, and in terms of ensuring that any contracts they enter into are properly entered into, and that they are above board, and that they are in the best interests of medical scheme concerned and of members. In terms of governance failures which have occurred and referred to the trustees, generally one finds that at the level where the Board of Trustees fails to carry out those very important obligations. And what then occurs is the registrar and the council for medical schemes is then required to obviously take action in terms of remedies which are contained in the Medical Schemes Act and which are at our disposal. And what we would typically then do is to examine the particular scheme that's failing. We would invariably start that off by way of inspection into that scheme. And once we've established what the causes of the failures are, to the extent that those are occasioned by the trustees, for instance, not taking proper care of the funds of the schemes, and there's errant behavior, one of two things can happen. Either individual errant trustees may be removed from the medical scheme in terms of the provisions of the Act, Section 46, or alternatively, the registrar would approach the council for the appointment of a curator to take control, to seize control of that particular scheme. And generally what would then happen is the Board of Trustees would step aside for the duration of that curatorship. Moving on then to some of the concerns that I've touched on one of them. One of the areas where problems have arisen is where one finds a very strong administrator influence on the affairs of some certain medical schemes. And typically what would then happen is trustees might be prevailed upon not to carry out their duties as they're required to do in terms of the Act, in terms of the governance structure. And what then typically would happen is one might at that level, in terms of that relationship, find behavior which is unacceptable, and that can precipitate a range of different interventions, as I've mentioned, ranging from inspections right through to ultimately curatorship, which is probably the strongest court of action which the regulator is entitled to take in terms of seizing control of that. And I'll speak a little more to curators just now when I touch on that specific point. The instances with the relationship between the Board of Trustees and the administrator are not arm's length, and that's what the Board of Trustees in carrying out their obligations are obviously required to ensure happens. And there are instances where we identify cases where that's not the case, and that of course is very precipitates and is the beginning, the start of problems which are experienced by the schemes in terms of the disbursement of those very important funds. And honourable chair, members of the committee, important to remember that those funds are trust funds. Those funds are held in trust by the medical scheme on behalf of and for the benefit of all the members of the scheme in terms of primarily the healthcare spend. I'll touch a little just now on non-healthcare expenditure. My colleague has already touched on that to an extent. Third of the boards we find lacking expertise, the required expertise and the necessary skills mix, and that's also an obligation imposed in terms of Section 57. Boards of Trustees must ensure that they have the requisite skills, and to the extent that they don't have, the Act, Section 57, enjoins them to ensure that they then go outside and obviously source those requisite skills, whether they be accounting skills, they may be legal in nature or even actuarial, that they then obtain the requisite skills and have the necessary advice given to them so that they're obviously able to carry out their fiduciary responsibilities in a responsible and a proper way. The current situation as the Act stands at the moment is that we do not have clear, fit and proper standards set out in the legislation, and I'll refer you now to some of the interventions that we're proposing, the Council is proposing by way of proposed medical schemes amendment bill that really talks to making those changes so that we're able to ensure there is a proper framework in place to ensure that fit and proper standards are well established in these schemes. In terms of our response to the various governance concerns, and I've touched on some of that, important that the provisions in the Medical Schemes Act must be strengthened, and just now I'll touch in the later slide just on some of the proposed amendments in the draft Medical Schemes Amendment Bill. Then, of course, there's ongoing and continued enforcement of the existing provisions of the Act. I've mentioned our powers, the powers of the Council, the Registrar's Office to inspect medical schemes, and to call for information. They're fairly wide-ranging powers as they currently stand. We have certainly sought to strengthen them as well in terms of what is proposed in the Medical Schemes Amendment Bill. And we have a well-developed system of compliance within the Office of the Registrar, which on an ongoing basis, proactively, is able to either conduct inspections on the basis of information that comes to the attention of the registrar, or alternatively, even routine inspections are conducted on a regular basis and very often reveal the beginning and the start of concerns which enable us to act proactively in those instances. There are a number of schemes that are currently under curatorship. We know about the Medshield Medical Scheme, and then there's also the Sesbury Medical Scheme, and more recently the HOSMED Medical Scheme have been placed under curatorship after long and protracted concerns and ongoing battles, if one likes, between the regulator and these particular schemes in order to attempt to ensure that they comply with their governance obligations. So currently, Chairperson and members of the honourable members of the committee, that is the current status in terms of schemes under curatorship. It's a very important tool, and it's a tool which we've used to great effect in terms of turning schemes around. Curators go into the medical scheme, they correct the imbalances and the problems and the irregularities which have led to the curatorship, and once the scheme has been turned around and the scheme is on an even heel again, the curatorship typically is lifted and the scheme is restored to its indicated governance structure, namely a fit and proper board of trustees, and then obviously carefully and closely monitored by the office and the council. In terms of the governance structure of the council itself, the council obviously has a board, typically a consisting of the members of the council, which oversees at a non-executive level, it oversees the function of the council, it's therefore strategic direction, and obviously a very important interface with the Ministry of Health, and serving under the council, obviously in terms of the office at the executive level, one has the Registrar of Medical Schemes, currently our acting registrar, Sir Lujo is acting in that capacity. And then we have a number of different units, operational units, which fall within the Office of the Registrar, typically some of whom are represented here today. Financial Supervision Unit, which looks at the financial performance of schemes. There's a Legal Services Unit. There's a Research and Monitoring Unit. The Registrar has made reference to the HR Unit. And then we also have a Benefits Management Unit, which manages the benefits, an accreditation unit, and a number of other important units which really deal with the executive functions of the office. Then, looking beyond that, just to certain of the important committees that fall within the office and within the scope of the council, so the special committees of council, we have an appeal committee of the council, and there's an appeal board which is appointed by the minister consisting of three persons, and these two different tribunals essentially would hear at an in-house level, at the level of the office, any appeals against decisions which are taken, firstly either by medical schemes themselves, with which members may be aggrieved by, or alternatively where the registrar himself has made a decision, a disgruntled member, aggrieved member is entitled to bring that particular decision to the appeals committee at the first level, and to the second level it would then be escalated to the appeal board if such member or even scheme were to be unhappy with the outcome of the particular matter which is heard. And then, of course, beyond that, after the appeal board has heard the matter, if a party still remains aggrieved, they're entitled to take the matter on review to the High Court. What we've done, and members, honourable members of the committee, have you read that the alternative dispute resolution processes, both are made reference to in the King 3 report, and recently have really gained some momentum, both internationally and certainly nationally as well, in terms of resolving disputes, not only at the regulatory level, such as our level, but certainly also at the level of litigants in courts and at the level of commercial, in terms of commercial transactions, commercial litigation. We have a very well-developed system of mediation in the labor arena, in the labor field, but commercial arbitration, commercial mediation of late has really gained a lot of momentum. And what we've done as council proactively, the office has embraced alternative dispute resolution as a means and a mechanism to really thin out and weed out some of the dead wood, if you like, some of the types of disputes which really can be resolved at a level of between the parties, i.e. either the medical scheme and its particular member, and even onward from there in terms of the office intervention, before those matters are heard by either the appeals committee or the appeal board at the council level. We have taken steps to implement proactively a system of alternative dispute resolution. We've also, as part of that, engaged in the process of proactively implementing a pro bono legal process, members of the committee, where, in terms of which we are able to assist members who cannot afford the requisite legal representation that they sometimes require, because many of these matters turn on very intricate principles of law, and these are argued before these various tribunals, and you often find there's an asymmetry in terms of the ability of people to be properly represented, where schemes can afford counsel, as lawyers and the members have some difficulty with that, we are able to assist them. In terms of the alternative dispute resolution process, really the system, as I've briefly indicated already, where the parties seek to negotiate or to mediate their dispute between themselves. That doesn't work, then it escalated to the next level, which in our specific case at the council would refer to us intervening and assisting members in terms of the alternative dispute resolution process which we put in place. We've engaged with recognized bodies who are assisting us since we've completed a pilot project in this regard. And I think it's important to remember and to note that the advantages of alternative dispute resolution are many. They firstly prevent undue costs and delays in the process, and as you know, formal processes can be very lengthy and very costly. They relieve congestion of cases so that the cases which ultimately are heard by the requisite and relevant dispute tribunals at the office are only the relevant matters, and they mitigate the negative effect on relationships, I think, which is very important, because in formal litigation, when one party invariably wins and one loses, you have people where relationships essentially are often destroyed, where mediation actually avoids that rather unpleasant consequence, and we believe is a very positive part of the process. Looking at our responses to the AER, I think I already mentioned that we've implemented the system. We've also looked at, and we've incorporated it more formally, and I'll speak to that off this when I get to the slide on the amendment bill. We've incorporated formally at the office level now. We've completed a pilot project, and we're also looking at it at scheme level, so that we're requiring medical schemes as well to also implement alternative dispute resolution. Looking at the proposed changes in terms of the medical schemes amendment bill, I think it's important. I'm just going to touch on a few important aspects there, Madam Chair, if I may. And really, essentially, what we've looked at there is looking at the amending the bill in order to look at some of the aspects related to improved information management. Most importantly, we're looking at including a beneficiary registry in terms of which all beneficiaries will form part of a registry. It's going to be a very involved process. We've embarked on it in terms of the next financial year. And I think it's very important to note the extent to which this will also facilitate and support the national health insurance process as well. So it's, we believe, a critical intervention, not only in terms of how medical schemes are governed, but also in terms of the wider process, the wider mandate and the wider initiative around NHI. Of course, importantly as well, we've sought to incorporate what's currently called the practice code numbering system in terms of which providers wish to receive direct reimbursement from medical schemes are required to have a practice code number. This particular contract is currently outsourced in terms of our legislation that currently we're proposing a very important amendment to allow that to be brought in-house so that the council can actually administer that particular system together with the beneficiary registry to ensure just the efficiencies in terms of the cost of the system and the requisite information that surrounds that. There are a number of new factors relating to membership, and those really concern the waiting periods. We're also requiring that medical schemes will now be required, in terms of the proposal in the amendment bill, to have a table of contributions as well. I think many members of the committee may be that the benefit options which members are confronted with are often very complex, very complicated, very difficult to understand. And the table of contributions will greatly facilitate and ease the transparency for likes which we can find in terms of which is lacking at the moment in terms of how members understand those benefit options. Prescribed minimum benefits are proposed to become mandatory minimum benefits. They will be written into the main body of the Act. And then through that process, firstly, there'll be greater clarity in terms of what the mandatory minimum benefits require, and then also in terms of regulation, the minister's ability to amend those benefits in a far more streamlined fashion than is currently the case will also be facilitated by that particular amendment. Complaints procedures have also been proposed to be streamlined in terms of shortening that process. I've already referred to the alternative dispute resolution mechanism that we are incorporating in the amendment bill. And then moving on to the appeal processes, the appeal procedures, we're proposing to take one of the tiers out of the system, that instead of a two-tier system, we'll now have a single-tier system which will simply comprise of the appeal board, and that board will have two panels that will then hear the records of complaints that are placed before the council, for the office. And then finally, on the governance provisions, I've mentioned the challenges of governance of medical schemes. The amendment bill proposes a code of conduct for the trustees of medical schemes. It proposes fit and proper standards, and also proposes that trustees be subjected to proper examinations to ensure they're able to test and check that they are in fact fit and proper to carry out the functions which they must carry out. And then finally, Madam Chair, just in terms of the council's response, there's continued engagement with schemes on an ongoing basis regarding their non-healthcare costs. My colleagues have already made reference to that. We've referred to amendments proposed to the Medical Schemes Act to strengthen our regulatory powers. Then researching the level of out-of-pocket expenditure, we've made reference to that. That's on an ongoing basis, the 18%, which was referred to earlier. And then also the encouragement of medical schemes to enter into proper managed care arrangements, which add value ultimately to their ability to deliver quality health care to their members. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Madam. So we're continuing with our goals, and I think my colleagues have spoken to the two goals. The first goal is that of being an effective and responsive organization. And I think this talks to our in-house strength, our infrastructure. I think in any organization, for an organization to function, you need proper infrastructure, like your IT infrastructure. And I think in our case, I think we're indicating that our IT infrastructure is almost outdated. I think the last time we went on a tender to acquire this IT infrastructure was in 2006. And I think we've maintained this infrastructure, but it's getting old, and I think we need to be looking into funding the new infrastructure so that we remain efficient and effective as a regulator. And I think the next component, of course, of any organization is your human resource management processes. In any organization, employees are the much valued assets, much valued resources, and as a council for medical things, we value our employees very much, and I think in that regard, there are many projects that we embark on that may identify ourselves as employer of choice, including benchmarking our benefits, benchmarking our salaries with the market, and we've got recruitment and retention policies in place.
We also embark on some strategic projects like succession planning, and also we have got a performance management system in place where good performance is rewarded. So our employees are our most important resource at the Council for Medical Schemes. In terms of financial management, we've indicated that a Schedule 3 entity under the Public Finance Management Act, we are governed by that particular act and its related treasury regulations, as well as the supply chain management process. This is an important aspect in our case, and I think we don't have a dedicated supply chain management unit like in other organizations, but we're moving towards establishing that. In this year, we're just employed one person in the supply chain management area, because there are many challenges in that area. Our audits have revealed that we need strengthening that aspect of financial management. Internal controls, I think we have sound internal control system. We've got an internal audit service in place as required by the Act. Also, we've got an audit risk management committee as well, because that one is also required in terms of our treasury regulations. And I think Mr. Krim is saying, as a member of the Finance Committee, also serving on the Audit and Risk Management Committee from the Council side. And more importantly, we have a budget, and unfortunately we've got a limited budget. We were not able to undertake the projects that we wish to, and the most important one is that our legal fees, we have been challenged. I think my colleagues have alluded to that, we have been challenged on the legal front, and I think we're spending quite a lot of money in defending our position, because as a regulator, as an species of law, we operate according to law, and we receive a lot of challenges in that area. And the other important aspect is that we need to offer office accommodation from where we function. We've just moved to a new building last year, and we've not occupied the full building because of the limited budget. But gradually, we're moving towards occupying that building in phases. I think what has happened this year, most importantly, is that we've taken the other phase of this building, and we have a nice conference hall where, for example, in this year, we are having all our conferences and most of our workshops in-house, in line with the cost containment measures that was issued by the National Treasury at the beginning of this year, so that we take calls, we're no longer going out to have our conferences outside the office. So that is in the area of our financial management. And I think we may at this point say that we have been receiving unqualified audits in successive years, and we've just concluded an audit for the financial year 2013-14, and an opinion even at this stage is an unqualified audit opinion, which we will be contained in our annual report as we finalize it. The fourth goal is that one of providing strategic advice to the ministry. As we indicated, this goal clearly defines our interaction with our executive authority, being the Minister of Health. And in this regard, if the proposed TMB regulations must first be ratified by the ministry, the amendment bill is with the Department of Health. We're engaged in the demarcation regulations as issued by the National Treasury, and I think most importantly, we want to place ourselves in a good position to make a contribution to the NHI development processes. Then, having said that, we then developed a budget so that we can meet our objectives in the financial. But at this stage, I'm going to require the chairperson of our Finance Committee just to give an introductory remark around the budget process. And I'll give the details, or maybe take questions afterwards. Maybe Chairperson can as well deal with the whole matter. But we'll take questions around the budget once he is done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, thank you, Dan, for the introduction. Chair, just a few remarks. Maybe I should use this one. Just a few remarks in terms of the annual process in terms of our budget. Chair, the Council meets on an annual basis to review and update the strategy and the strategic framework in which we operate, aligned to legislation, to take into consideration the developments over the last year and new areas of focus that needs to be made in the next financial management cycle. Having done that, we, as a Finance Committee, set wide or high-level budget parameters for management. The registrar with his management team then develop zero-based budgets for the different business units in line with their strategic objectives that have been set and reviewed by council. they then submit their first draft budget to the executive management group for their first discussion around that, which is then tabled to the finance committee for its first review and challenge. And we quite often send them back to management because usually there's a bit of a wish list, and we have to act responsibly in terms of managing the cost increases for members of this scheme. After we send management back, they go and make those refinements and changes, and then they submit the fine budget to the finance committee when we do our final review, and then recommend for approval to the full council. Once the council is happy with that, Chair, there may be a few minor adjustments the council may require from time to time. We then also present that to the executive authority, being the Minister of Health, and our legislation also then requires concurrence with the Minister of Finance, and there's usually another review process at that stage with Treasury and Health officials, and if they do require any adjustments, that gets referred back to council, and we then make those adjustments as requested. And then finally the letter of concurrence and approval by the two relevant ministers are then issued to council. And after that we then publish our levy notice that we then submit to the council, to these medical schemes, to then pay their levies and dues to the council, which they do in two installments, if I'm not mistaken. Chair, just to reiterate that we try to run a clean ship and a tight ship as far as the finances are concerned. I think we have run for the last 13 consecutive years with an unqualified audit opinion, with the Auditor General's report. That may be some record, I think, in public service. And also just to reiterate as well, in terms of the allegations against the registrar at this stage, there's certainly none that seems to point to the internal finances of the council itself with relation to matters outside council, and we do not expect there to be any allegations in relation to the internal financial management of the council for medical schemes. As I said, as the acting registrar has indicated, we have just completed the audit by the Auditor General. The audit report is meant to be issued by tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken, and having had sight of that draft audit report at the last audit committee meeting, it is again an unqualified audit opinion, and the Auditor General is certainly aware of the allegations that have been made, and they've not found any impropriety in the finances of the council itself. With that, Chair, I'd like to hand over to the registrar to take us through the budget in detail.
Thank you, Chair. I think in developing this budget, there were some considerations that were taken into account. The most important one, like I've indicated, is the salary of employees. We've just awarded our employees a salary increase of 5.9%, 6.9% here, but the council decided to reduce the 6% by a percentage point, we only got 5.9%. I think we're indicating that we're in the fourth month of this financial year. That's how we're operating. And I've indicated, I've alluded to the fact that we've moved into a new building and we're trying to use the in-house venue for conferences so that we reduce expenses, because we're aware that our budget is limited. And we've only this year appointed or approved three positions, one in the accreditation unit, and I think the person is starting, in the compliance unit, we've appointed a senior investigator, and in the internal finance unit, we're appointing a supply chain officer. Our budget, I think, is our operational budget is about 123 million. And I think if you just put this with the contribution, the annual contribution or the annual turnover of the industry, which is about 107 billion, this is quite a small amount. This is quite a small amount. We are operating on a budget of 125 vis-a-vis 107 billion industry. So it's quite a challenge. That is why our legal challenges were very prudent in terms of choosing which factors to engage in because of our limited budget. This budget then determines our levy. The levy amount for this year is only 27.8 cents per member per annum. The total membership this year is about 3.9. We base this calculation on 3.9 million principal members. This does not include our beneficiaries. So we arrived at the levy amount of about 27.80 cents, which was a 6.95% increase from last year. And this is just to show over the last years, since 2009 to 2015, the levy has increased from 13.89 cents to about 27.80 cents. And this will indicate it's only a principal member. We're not changing the whole 8.7 life that we're covering in the. And I think this is just a graphic presentation in terms of the MCN descriptions. The bulk of that, as you can see, goes to our salaries, almost 60%, 59.7%. This is typical of a service institution like ourselves. You go to institutions similar to us, you see that the bulk of the expenditure goes to salaries, and the rest goes to goods and services and our capital expenditure. I think that is just the same thing, is just to show you the expenditure per unit. I think my colleague has indicated we've got several business units in the institution, and that is the expenditure per unit in terms of that budget, the representation of that budget. And I think we've alluded to the fact that the major budget items, the bigger one is personnel costs, which includes your salaries and other benefits, and the second one is your legal fees, and the other one is the rental. As I've indicated, we are occupying our own building now, and the other expenses represent the balance of the percentage of the pie. And at present, we're employing about 105 people. We're not that big, but that's how the composition of our institution at this present moment. And I think we're done, Madam Chair. Thank you very much in terms of our presentation.
Thank you very much. I've seen the hand myself, Dr. James. Safe to say, I don't know whether it's me. As we were talking, I was presenting, I was trying to look in this document. Some of the things that you were talking about were not in the presentation, and there was never any indication that they are in this document. But nevertheless, members, maybe they will. I don't know, maybe they will talk on that. It depends in terms of the identification. Honorable Musa?
No, thanks, Chair. Just some few observations before maybe one ask questions. Because I think we have received this particular document, which was our point of departure and preference. I presuppose when we are preparing for this meeting, all of us as members of this portfolio committee. Now, the issues that we are going to raise are going to be based on this particular document here. One, the observation which I think you will clarify is that the date on which the report was tabled in Parliament has not been updated. I'm talking about the previous Parliament now. The cover page also here, it's not correct. It refers to November 13, 2013, on this particular document. That's the first thing. The second thing that one has observed is that your strategic plan is not aligned to the department strategic plan. And your strategic plan is not a five-year plan. So maybe if you can just clarify us on that aspect. The forward by the minister on the strategic plan is merely a copy and paste from the previous strategic plan. I'm not sure does that have to do with the input of the chair that your report is annual and so on and so forth. You are still operating within the last financial year, the presentation is based on the last financial year or not. page 13 of the strategic plan on the relevant court rulings, for example, has not been updated from the last year's one. Does this therefore mean that there has not been any progress with regard to those issues under the relevant court rulings? In terms of your trend of analysis, it does not include your 2013, when the APP is for 2014-15. The question would be why is there a lagging in the statistics? Your explanatory notes under figures page 16, 19 and 22 are an exact copy and paste from the last year's report. It's not updated according to the changes with regard to the data that we have provided. Explanatory notes under table 4.33 and 5.1 on page 43 and 47 respectively remains unchanged from the previous report, and the date refers to 2013-14 financial, which is a clear indication of a cut and paste from where I am sitting. You'll have to clarify that. With reference to your APP on research and monitoring, which is on page 47, research and monitoring, for example, what was reported in the last financial year remains unchanged, still the same. Now, maybe before we go to the questions, Chair, if you had listened to my lady there when she was making a presentation, she said the data that she's presenting is outdated, is of 2012, which then now puts the question to us as the committee, because whatever that we have, after we have finalized the discussions and so on and so forth, the report must be submitted to Parliament. And she said that they are still busy with the opening and so on and so forth. So the question then becomes, is it really worthwhile for us as this particular committee to continue in that particular line while there is some internal processes that are going on? And also when there are this particular error that we have actually discovered. If maybe we can sort out that thing, I think it will be better, because we don't want to submit the very same thing that was submitted in the last fourth parliament. You know, and we would rather appreciate the situation where a proper presentation with the latest updates, once you have done your internal planning, once it is sorted out, then you can come back and submit to us, and then we can then submit the proper report to Parliament. I've got lots of questions, but the difficulty is actually proceeding with the questions when there are these particular issues, and I'm not sure whether is it the same observation from the members of the committee, you know. But for me, sir, the issues for now that I think one has picked up, you know. Thank you, Chair.
Before I allow the second honourable member, there's a question that has been asked, which I think before we can move. The question that you said that yourself, I didn't want to say that upfront because I want the members to answer that the document, this is 2012, and you said the current information is with printers as we speak, and I was sitting there asking myself, am I understanding you correctly? And I think there's another member that has picked up the issue of 2012, and so that we get clarity on that, and that we move on. I want you to understand that we don't want to be seated here, whereas we are going to present in Parliament a report that again will come at the end of the term or somewhere in the term. No, no, now we are presenting this when we have presented a report of it. So if you can clarify that, and then we are going to be able to move on.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The Acting Registrar will speak to the SPHP process. I'm just going to speak to how we get medical scheme data, which is the statistics that I spoke to. In front of the Medical Schemes Act, medical schemes are supposed to submit audited financial statements 4 months after year end. So it means for December 2013, we only received data in April 2014. And then that data must be analyzed and processed such that it becomes an annual report, what we include in our annual report. There's also a statutory requirement for when we need to submit our annual report, and again, I think that is in August. So we are actually on track in terms of 2013 data. 2013 is not yet in the public domain because it's still being processed. So which is why as part of 2014-15, the data that we had available in terms of medical schemes is 2012 data. So it's just a process issue, and all of it is contained in it simply because of the timing of when we receive data from medical schemes, data that is audited. And just to clarify, as I speak, we haven't even received, we've just received quarter one of 2014, and we are in July. That is just how the process works. Because you first need to get audit results of the previous year before you can get ongoing financial reporting from medical schemes.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the date and the 5-year strategic process, let's clarify. This strategic plan that we're talking to now is for the financial year 2014-15, which would have been developed during the year 2013. That is why you see our date, November 2013. That is the date on which we submitted this plan to our board to approve. And the date of the 12th of March, we're supposed to be here on the 12th of March. We have confirmed that we had received information that we were supposed to be here. But because of the elections this year, we were not able to come here to present these plans for the financial year 2014-15. That is why I've indicated that we're almost 4 months into this financial year, and because of the delays of the elections, which we all know in this country, took place in the portfolio committee on health couldn't sit before the elections for us to come and put this. And the strategic plan that we have developed is for 5 years. As you can see, we started from 2010, it's ending now in the financial year 2014-15. We are currently developing a new strategic planning document that will span from the financial year 2014 ending April 2019, which is the next term of this administration. The strategic plan coincides with the term of administration of government. And in terms of us not aligning ourselves with the government's program, if you've looked into this on page, I can't go to the page, we've alluded to the 10-point plan of government, which was a plan of the previous administration. As we're developing this strategic plan now for 2014 to 2015, the department has revised this standard. It's no longer relevant. We have gone into that status document. We're going to update this because there's no way we cannot align ourselves with the strategic plan of our executive authority. We're going to update that. You'll see a new document. Unfortunately, Madam Chair, like I indicated, we're supposed to be here in March, in which case you would have understood that this is the strategic plan of 2014-15. We'll be coming back here next year, maybe earlier in March, to present our new strategic plan, which you'll see will be a new document, different from this one.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You have responded on what, where I am seated, because I don't want to know where I am seated. I think you have planned fair to us. I'm fair in the sense, we are a new committee, okay? Two, yes, we are aware that we were in elections. We know it was stated that the committees were supposed to sit. But where I'm seated, it was supposed to be a responsibility before even you start presenting, as you have done with the issue of the register, to just take, to say, you will sit there because of this, because of that. You assume it's where I'm seated. You are assuming that we know. If it was, I'll make an example, if it was science and technology, I wouldn't have an issue with you because I'm from science and technology. All of us here, I knew in the portfolio committee of health. Therefore, that's why I'm saying you are unfair. You were just supposed to say, you will see this, don't be surprised, it's because of ABCND. So I think the question and the observations are justified on our side. But the only thing is that now, you are then now clarifying that
A thing, maybe how people make presentations differs from whatever area, but in my understanding, I would have thought that for members to be able to understand, to say, this is the situation, don't be surprised, and this, the act, and whatever. So, I don't know, that's why I thought that I must come in, because we wanted you to clarify that. I think you have clarified. I want to get members. There were members. I want just members. I know you are going to ask questions, but just for us to clarify this and be able to move forward. Honorable Rusale, I'm sorry, Honorable Maitale, and Honorable James, that on this matter of the days and when they are to present their financial years, the formats that they do what they're supposed to present in August. Much I'm not going to go into that because we know the situation, but it is your failure, and I need to be corrected by you. It is your failure to explain to members, to make them comfortable, to understand that we are not dealing with a report that has been dealt with, it's an old report. And we have partners.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The Honorable Gentleman here said that maybe next month they will be presenting the 2014-2015 strategic plan that is aligned to government policies, because these other ones are irrelevant. And he wants us to discuss 2011-2012. Because 2012-2013 is still in the printer somewhere. Now, why are we going to deal with things that are irrelevant and that are no more relevant? It is a waste of time to really give us this latest document and say the other one is still in the printers. And so we must interrogate this one, then you bring this one when next year.
Please, members and board members of CNS, allow members to raise the views. Don't your body language will not give me. Allow us. You are here to assist us to understand the sector. So please, when the members are raising issues, don't grumble. Don't grumble. I hear you said, yes. I'm humbly requesting you be patient with us. We have been patient with you. These are the questions that we have to ask, because we need to understand we are going to play an oversight. And we can't play an oversight role on an area that we just, you say this and we agree and we go, no. That's this committee. We are not going to allow. So be patient with us, and then you will then come and make us understand and clarify. After Honorable Maitale, it was Honorable James.
Chair, the body language is not going to help that, because we are not going anywhere. It's not going to help anybody. They better understand that we need to understand why they give us this and that are irrelevant. So we will be patient enough for you to take the one from the printers, when it's well printed and well documented, and bring it to us. Then we can comment on that. This one, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. I had a substantive question, so not a process question. That's okay. I mean, the process questions are important. And the substantive question is that if you look at the present patterns when it comes to life expectancy, and you'll see that you've extended life expectancy of South Africans by about 5 years of 2004, larger as a result of getting HIV under control. And that will be expected to continue into the future. And everything else being equal, if you were to model the population as demographically over the next 30 years, what will obviously happen is that you're going to see a decline in revenue that can only be met by increasing out-of-pocket payments and or increasing the rates that you would charge. Now, I'm sure you've modeled this story against the demography under the present disease burden that you have. And principally what normally the way Mr. Margulis would look at us is that we are in the middle of a transition from high mortality and high fertility to low mortality and low fertility. But South Africa is complex because we also, with aging now, are accumulating a whole range of quite expensive non-communicable diseases as the population grows older. And that particular mix is, I mean, I won't even begin to try and understand your sector because of all the actuarial calculations you have to make to get this thing right in terms of money and whatever. But clearly, there's going to be an increased funding gap. That will only get worse, and you only have a limited number of instruments you can use to close. So the question is, what do you expect to do under the circumstances?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are aware of this challenge, and affordability is a real issue. And if we look at prevalence of all the CDR conditions in the private medical scheme industry, and the trend is upwards, and also for HIV it's upwards. We must make sure that managed care is actually working, but then we need to look at price regulation. We need to look at the regulatory framework also. It is a challenge, and that the life expectancy can also, together with age, put even more pressure on affordability issues. But we need to work together with the Department of Health and find ways to make healthcare more affordable. But what I can tell you also, our risk profile and our prevalence in the private medical scheme industry is not the same as for the public. Our prevalence rates are much, much, much lower. I think our HIV is sitting at 3%. So, but we are aware of the challenges, and that is why we need to work together with the Department of Health. And one of the things is the story about preventative care that will serve your downstream costs. We need to look at that in primary care.
I didn't want to make the meeting a bit tense. I didn't want Honorable James not to ask the question. But I think the committee will still want to make us understand whether is it will it be fair to ourselves and yourselves to allow you to continue when we are still in the dark with the issue of the process. I think you have to bear with us. So that is why I have allowed him to ask that question, and there was a response. But the issue of the process, the question on the table, still we still need you to clarify.
Thank you, Chair. I think we want to apologize for our body language, maybe. I think we want to reiterate the documents are not outdated. I think we must clarify that. And also to understand that we are talking about two documents. The documents that are still going to print the annual report, which must be published 5 months after the end of our financial year. And we must also clarify, Chairperson, that our financial year is not a calendar year. Our financial year ends March every year. That's also what we must differentiate. And also that the financial year of FIMS also runs on a calendar or on a calendar year. That's another complication. And therefore, Chairperson, what we are saying is that this documents that are presenting were developed last year for the financial year 2014-15, which ends next year March. So we're correct to present this in this period. What we are saying is that the next cycle of strategic plan is just that we are planning for 15-16. Which is in this year 2014. And those documents will be approved by our council in November of 2014, which documents will be presented maybe as the schedule of Parliament in March of 2015. So that is about the confusion that arises. It's too late into this financial year to have this discussion. And I think we appreciate the fact that it's because of the shifting of the dates of the by the portfolio committee, but our documents are not outdated in a sense. There are the documents that must be discussed in this financial year, as they relate to the financial year that ends next year, March 2015. Thank you very much.
Honourable members, that is the response in terms of the on the question at hand. And honourable minister.
Thank you. But we are having documents in front of us to be looked at. We are not just saying these ones are outdated and these ones are not updated. Because you see, we have to extract our questions from these documents, and we have to do oversight on what is contained in this document. And if they are outdated or they are old documents, the ones for 2013, 2014 are still going to come. It's not just a financial statement. Okay, like Honorable Musala here was saying that your statement, these documents are not aligned with those of the department. And this is the contentious issue. That what are we going to do if they are not aligned? And you said, no, the new ones, sure, they are going to be aligned for 1915, somewhere 2015, 2016, or those ones are going to be aligned. We are not going to work in the future, we are working now. Okay, and this is the thing that we are going to use to interact with you and to be able to do oversight, not in future. So we are not arguing. We are merely pointing out that we are constrained by this document. If you could give us current document aligned with those of the department. And some maybe the honorable lady back there is from the department. You can cock up him quickly and see whether these things are aligned with his document. Thank you, Chair.
So, honorable members, Honorable Musari, it's the chair that we then have to I could see the hands of the department before allowing other maybe department ones to assist in that way.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think it's a difficult situation because this document was supposed to be discussed in March, and now we are discussing it in July. And the council, given that the document was not discussed in March, is moving forward in developing its documents to be presented for next year. So I think the colleague from the council was referring to the next document, is talking about preparations going forward for next year. Their alignment is alignment with our plans as we present it. So at the time when they prepared their document, which the document that was supposed to be presented in March, it was aligned to our document because that's the latest information that they had. And we had approved it based on that. After that, obviously the department changed a number of areas that we needed to look at. And so they would need to align to our new plans, if I can put it like that. So that's the challenge I think the council has, and that's where the alignment issue is coming.
Before you, the chair's hands up.
I will say, clearly there is a gap in expectation and timing, and we do apologize for that. We came here prepared with the documents that we would have, as indicated earlier, would have prepared much earlier or presented much earlier in the year. And we are sitting in a period where we are busy preparing the next cycle, of strategic plans. And we take the point very, very clearly that it's not relevant if we are not fully aligned with the new strategy of the Department of Health, and if it's not forward-looking in terms of the next term. So in that context, sure, clearly the strategy issues, strategic issues, may not necessarily be relevant in terms of your expectations for this meeting. And like I said, we do apologize for that from the council perspective. We certainly would need to go back and update all our documents to make sure that it's properly aligned in terms of the next strategy. And in terms of assisting the committee, it may be necessary for us to meet the committee earlier than March next year. Because I think even that would be too late. Because by then we would be presenting budgets, etc., which was already being committed to by the council, and would not have benefited from the input of this committee. I take that point, Chair, and would certainly still welcome any further interaction in terms of the substance of the document that we would for the financial year that we are in now, which was based on our last strategic plans. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Minister.
No, thanks, Chair. I think with the latest input, it does, you know, put things into perspective now, you know, and I would then suggest that we can then proceed with the engagement with the council, you know, and on all substantive issues. I think when we've got an opportunity also on our own, you know, as the committee would then reflect, you know, on this particular issue.
You still want to?
I was thinking that the honorable gentleman here actually made the whole thing to be now in perspective. Because you see, we are going to deal with the department's documents, your document. And if they are not aligned, what's the point of just saying, okay, we are here, we've got documents? It's not going to be helpful to us. So the sooner you align them and bring them to us, we interrogate them and start acting on them. We will see as we go into the future. I think that's the honorable thing to do. Thank you.
Why don't the commission take the process? Allow them to allow honorable members to reflect, take the points, and then you'll see who will divide among themselves, who responds on what. Because an agreement is that the alignment with what the department is saying, that gap has been identified, but on substantive issues, we can, the committee, because that's what I'm picking up out. So I would request not to respond on one-on-one.
Thank you, Chairperson, for that direction. Going then to the substantive issues, bearing in mind the challenges on process, just a few questions. First is with regards to your managed care model. You spoke about the fact that if you have a service provider that goes kind of off script and then prescribes a drug that isn't part of the agreed upon managed care model, that there may be co-co payments that may then be incurred. If the beneficiary then has to pick up obviously those co payments, but the decision was made by the healthcare provider, is that fair? And is it as a way of actually maybe adjusting the model so that the beneficiary isn't penalized because of potentially improved sort of care of that patient? The second question I have is around your fourth goal, which is advising the minister in terms of NHI. And you spoke about the fact that, I mean, the green paper on NHI speaks about a risk-adjusted capitation model of reimbursement of providers. You raise concerns in this document about the technical capacity that will be required to implement that. Now, we understand that that model potentially is very cost-effective, but, you know, technically and in terms of administration would be very difficult. And given the limitations of administrative capacity that you pointed out in your presentation, do you think it's practical for such a model to be sort of NHI at the outset, or should we gradually move into that type of into the model with a sort of fee-for payment model used up front? The other question I had was just around just lastly, your codification. You use ICD codification, and I know that internationally there is also the diagnosis related goods, DRGs. Just what is your thinking behind using that form of codification for payments? Thank you.
No, thanks, Chair. In terms of the presentation, mention was made that we have identified that gap, that bottleneck. Expectations and skills, and the only way in which this can be attended to is to enter an amendment to the Act. Now, the question then remains, if the amendment is going to take 20 years, it means we will be sitting with 20 years lack of skills and capacity within the hubs, and the problem will be exacerbated. That's one. The second issue that I want to ask is that in terms of the budget in this particular document, you know, and I see there is a variation between last year's allocation to goods and services. There is for 1.4 million for the last financial year and 8.3 million for 2014-2015. That is on page 8. The question is that an error or is it a correct figure? Because there's a huge gap there. 8.3 million versus for 1.4 million. I mean, I'm not sure whether it's a
you clarify that for us. The other issue relates to the issue of reaching the audience. I mean, what mechanisms have you really put in place to reach audiences? In particular, your rural communities. You know, we have a strategy to make sure that the rural communities are actually reached. The issue of litigations, in terms of the budget also, there's quite a, you're spending a lot of money on litigations. Why is it that, why do you have that kind of a situation where your budget is actually, the increase is actually used with regard to your litigation? Thank you.
For myself, I've got two questions. The first is an experience that I had, and I think you are better place to explain to me. I went for a procedure, and I had to pay 6,000 more. And when I asked the doctor, when I asked the medical aid, he said, no, we are paying according to the scheme. The price related to the scheme. I was so confused. More than being confused, I was angry. But there was nothing that I can do about that. And this doctor said, no. You are in Parliament. Deal with this. What is that? What is this thing? And the second one, in 22, and in fact, let me say it up front to you. I don't know if you remember. The document is not reader friendly to somebody in a mall, because your area is quite complicated area, and it is not reader friendly for a lay person like me to understand. Who has never been so. There is an area which in 22 is a faster contributing blah blah blah, and in that it talks about brokers. What is the thing? How the brokering parts of in medical aid? Where do they come in? In which schemes are affected by that? We are raising these things because we want to understand. And we are raising these questions because ordinary members, when they see you as a public representative, when they are confronted with this, you are unable to respond. Fortunately, now I'm asking you about something that really affected me. The thing of a price according to the scheme. The last one, maybe it's a political one where maybe organizations are to deal with that. I couldn't believe the Honorable James when I had to pay for an ordinary swab. Getting some charge. I went for an unexpected thing and I was charged. I said, I was not even there for an hour. Why am I to pay 2 point something? And this anesthetist couldn't just believe. And when I had to look into the, I said, oh my God, that is why I think I was correct in my other area of work, never to be a member of medical aid, because at the end, it's about profit more than what, as much as we're saying, they're a non-profit organization. But nevertheless, make us to understand. We may be confused in your eye, but these are things that we need to. So for me, those are the two questions and that comment. So you divide yourselves on how to respond.
The kinders and the experts, I think Craig will deal with that one.
Thank you, Chair, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of the Committee. We have sought to strengthen the issue around the trustees as a question. But however, there is a safety net as the Act currently stands, because although trustees themselves may lack the requisite skills and expertise, That's the area we're seeking to strengthen in terms of the medical team. The amendment bill, the proposals contained therein, the provisions of Section 57(4G), I think, really answer the question in terms of the comfort that we require. In that it says that the duty of the Board of Trustees shall be to obtain expert advice on legal, accounting, and business matters as required, or in any other matter which the members of the Board of Trustees may lack sufficient expertise. So the legislature at the time, with Holland passed this particular piece of legislation, actually recognized, I think, that you might have this problem. And so what it then did was to place an obligation on the Boards of Trustees themselves to ensure that they then go and get that expertise from outside. So once they've identified that there is a problem and that they don't, they potentially not understand the complex issue with which they're grappling, once that arises, they're obliged to go out and ensure that they source the requisite business, legal, or whatever expertise is lacking. So it's a stopgap measure, if one likes. What we're seeking to do in the medical scheme amendment process is to really seek to strengthen the actual inherent capacity of the boards themselves. Thank you.
In the organization, we've got an education and training subunits within the stakeholder relations. They go all out in community radio stations. They go out on exhibitions. They go out like in the Rent is the Show, where we want to reach out to our audiences. But the issue of reaching out rural members is a challenge in that as we all are aware, there are no facilities, especially the modern day type of facilities or communication means. We rely mainly on the community station. We buy slots in community radio stations where we educate members in terms of our role in this industry. The other question, or as it relates to legal fees, I think in our presentation we've indicated that we are seriously challenged in terms of our decisions, the decisions we make. And I think I have a head of legal who can actually expatiate on that, but we also acquire the services of very highly skilled advocates, your SE and all those things. So they don't come necessarily cheap, but I want to refer this one to my head of legal, and we can deal with other questions as we go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The correctly, as the acting registrar said, what we found in inspections of certain schemes is that we found certain medical schemes have, as what we call a war chest, set aside, in fact, a budget sum equivalent to our entire budget for the entire year, just to fight specific cases. And that's invariably in those ones where there are problems. You equally find other schemes where the amount of money that they have in their legal budget is relatively low because they don't anticipate crossing swords with the regulator. So essentially that's the issue. And I think a judge recently in the Meshfield case underlined this, where someone raised that actually in argument and said the council's legal budget, it's concerning that it's high, you know, similar along the same lines. And the judge's remark was, well, not only does he not consider it to be high, he considers it to be worryingly low in terms of the role and function that the regulator is required to perform, because it is such a critical function in ensuring that medical schemes comply, you know, and that's been the challenge. We've got a very active compliance and investigations unit which investigates, and obviously there's a lot of pushback when they do go into schemes and they do start to inspect and so on. And that, of course, translates invariably to urgent court applications to transport the inspectors, uncovering more information, further information. And, of course, these particular schemes brief, of course, only the very best senior counsel and attorneys and so on. And so it's a case, Madam Chair and members of the committee, of really meeting fire with fire in a way. And I think that really determines the budget, and we base it on the trends that we've experienced in the previous financial year. Thank you.
I wonder if I could just add to that, is that the Council for Medical Schemes litigates with great caution
and upon due consideration. In other words, we don't just proceed willy-nilly. Madam Chair has already made reference to the point of what a complex environment this is, and it is absolutely a complex environment. If we go through our staff component, the fact is we employ doctors, we employ accountants, we employ nurses, we employ health economists, we employ actuaries, and so it goes on and on, because this is a very, very complex environment. I would go so far as to say that it is probably to say that some of the smartest minds in the land are involved in this area, in medical schemes. And it is complex, and we'll deal with issues later on around scheme rules and so on and so forth. But certainly, from a litigation issue, we monitor it consistently, and we take advice, and the fruit of the pudding is often in the eating, is that it's probably true to say that the Council for Medical Schemes doesn't lose cases in court. That's not to say we will never lose cases in court, but that in fact tells the story of this increasingly litigious environment in which we operate.
The other question related to brokers and their role in the medical scheme, I will ask the worker to deal with that. What's the role of brokers?
Okay, brokers are essentially intermediaries that are supposed to recruit new members and also offer ongoing services to existing members. The currently is structured that your contribution that you pay every month includes a broker fee, and that typically in the current environment creates agency principal problem because of asymmetries of information, where potentially the broker is in possession of much more information than the very person that they seek to represent. So there has been a proposal to actually change the construct of that, such that the relationship between the broker is directly with the member and not through the maker scheme, such that the member is in control of the kind of services that they obtain and pay for that directly. That is essentially an intermediary between the member and the maker scheme in the current framework.
You want to deal with the managed care question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to try to answer the questions from the person from the BIA. I have to get your surname, Andres. I can't remember if this is the name correct. The managed care, the co-payments, remember the scheme may impose a co-payment. It's not that they can impose a co-payment, and there's provision in the Act, and if I can just take you through the co-payments. If a member receives a service often from a designated service provider or the users of a formulary drug, then there's generally no co-payment. That is how it's supposed to work. Now, if they obtain the service from not from a designated service provider, then it splits. Then if it was voluntary, otherwise the member was informed that you're going to use a non-designated service provider, knowing that you were informed of the consequences, then there will be a co-payment. Then if it was involuntary, otherwise it was emergency, or the designated service provider, it was just not available or too far out, then there will be no co-payment. That is no co-payment, but it is, the schemes may impose a co-payment. Regarding the NSI, I'm not sure if I understand you correct. I was involved in the risk equalization fund at the council years back where we looked at the risk adjustment. I still believe we need a system of risk adjustment. I showed you the graph, the differences in the risk profiles of medical schemes. That is unfair competition between the medical schemes. They are going to end up with the same situation in the NHI environment. And the risk might differ. I cannot really comment on the differences in the risk profile. But in the current medical scheme industry, we look at the current conditions, your health status in terms of the 25, 26 current conditions, including HIV and AIDS. Now, I expect also to see differences in the risk profiles if you want to implement the NHI system. Depends on how your variables that you're going to look at. But if there are differences, for example, the provinces or districts, then you need to seriously consider a system of risk adjustment, and council is more than willing to help in that process. We do have the experience on that. That is on the MSI risk adjustment, it will just bring fairness to the system. Then on the ICD coding versus diagnostic groups, I think Department of Health is maybe in a better position to respond to that. There was a project in the Department of Health. My comment on this is, I think the moment when they sort our basket, it will define the cost much more accurately. Then the memo would also be in a better position to expect what the cost is going to be. And there is some support in the industry for that. And I think what is currently happening, when there's no authorization, it is possible that providers that are going on ICD-10 cards, especially on PMB, so that they can know that they are PMB condition, that the scheme of paid in full. So that's a very valid question, and it's even a project that we can relook at and work closer with the department and the industry. And then the last question that I wanted to respond to, that was the comments from Madam Jay, the 6,000 rand that you had to pay out of your pocket, I feel for you. I had to make operation last year and I had to pay 20,000 out of my pocket, and I'm a member of American Ski. But it isn't complicated, and there was a payment because my operation, I'm not sure about your situation, was a non-PMP. It was not a PMP. If it is a PMP, then the scheme is supposed to pay in full. But it is very complicated. I cannot give you a clear answer here, but it also speaks to affordability of healthcare in this industry, and we really need to look to address all issues of affordability. Thank you.
Can I suggest there's a hand from the department, there are two hands from Honourable Miller. Remember that after this, we also have to deal with some of our issues, and we have got the transport challenges. We will check, I'll give the department and then the two members, and after that, we'll wrap up. And then remind one another of how then we are going to move forward. Dr. Play, Honorable Warwick, and Honorable myself.
Thank you, Jen. I thought it's important to clarify for the committee some issues, particularly around co-payments, because it's a big problem in this industry. Firstly, in the case of co-payments for medicines, I think it's important to recognize that in terms of the Medicines Act, when a patient presents him or herself to a pharmacy and has a particular drug listed on the prescription, if there is an alternative generic available, the pharmacist has a legal obligation to offer the patient that generic and to indicate that that generic is covered by their medical scheme. Unfortunately, because of the complexity of the matter, patients are abused, and so the pharmacist would prefer to sell something that's more expensive because he or she makes more money out of it, and say the other one's out of stock. And so I think that's where the co-payment comes in, and we're trying to see how we improve the education around it, because I think even the those that are in the industry often get caught up in this issue about co-payments in the case of medicines. Sean, the issue about co-payments of procedures like you are highlighting, it's an issue the minister on a day-to-day basis gets complaints. And the issue here is that the providers, particularly at the higher levels of care, particularly at specialists and hospitals, are designated in terms of what medical schemes negotiate with them. When one goes to provide outside the group, effectively what happens is that whatever the provider chooses to charge, they may charge, and you then are forced to pay the difference as a result of that. And if one is not aware of that upfront, that's when you get, I mean, we have cases of people being presented with a bill of 150,000 rand, and they're having to pay this, and they feel to the minister, how am I going to do this? Do I sell my car, my house, and how do I pay this? So it's a serious matter. And I think the Medical Schemes Amendment Act attempts to do that. And the other point I wanted to make is
The challenge we have is that in wanting to bring the Nenmenberg here to this house, we have a parallel process going on with the Department of Economic Development, where there is a commission of inquiry into pricing in the private health sector. We anticipate that that commission may make findings and recommendations that we as the department and the regulator would have to take on board. Now, we don't know when that process will complete itself, and so do we bring amendments and conclude those and then come back to this committee and make further amendments depending on what the findings are. I think it's a challenge I just wanted to lay up front. But there are a number of other challenges, I think, which my colleagues in the CMS have highlighted around governance, etc., that can't be plaguing the industry. So that's a timing thing, I think, I just want to highlight to the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the responses to those questions. I just wanted to have two quick follow-ups. On the issue of risk adjustment capitation, Sydney, you know, we appreciate the point of the fact that risk adjustment protects risk pools, that we then obviously ensure that those who are vulnerable, like those who are elderly and those who have a higher level of stakes are protected in turn. And that capitation also is preferred to fee for service because of cost effectiveness. But the question really was around the complexities of implementing a risk-adjusted capitation model in the NHI dispensation. I mean, that's massive. And you spoke about administrative challenges as it stands now. And the question really was, but how do we ensure that we've skilled up enough to be able to be robust enough to be able to handle that type of shift in payment, reimbursement? The second follow-up is around the ICD 10 code. Thanks again for clarifying that. It leads to a very important point about the collection of outcome data. And I know in the document here you speak about the fact that you do need to get data on outcomes that links to quality of care. You haven't yet been able to do that for understandable reasons, but that ICD-10 frame could help you as a precursor to that. How far along the process are you? I mean, when do you reasonably foresee you being able to collect data around outcomes so we can actually delve into issues around quality of care? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Since the PMBs are not affordable, and the managed care program is not value for money, that's what I heard from you. And you intend to revise these PPM packages, right? And the fact that so many of the schemes are under curatorship, and that so much against you. You better strengthen your legislative regimen so that you can counter all these things. Otherwise, you'll be in court all time. And if you want to win the game, you write the rules yourself. So write the rules, and anybody who goes out of that, you are defended. So all these things here is not going to help you. You are always going to sit in court and never do anything. And the people out there are milked dry while you're supposed to protect them. So we want to help you, and we want to work together. We are not antagonistic against you, but we just want to understand what we are up against, so that when we do these things, we do it together with your guidance. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. Response that there are two questions. Honourable Vonik asked some questions.
First of all, I'd like to thank the last Honourable Member for his comments, because that's certainly one of the reasons why we've drafted the amendments to the Medical Schemes Act. Act itself is about 15 years old, if I'm not mistaken, correct? Yeah. And we've learned through many of the legal challenges that we are facing that the schemes and the clever people and lawyers that they employ come up with various ways of trying to get around what's in the legislation. So we've learned a lot of lessons over this period of time, and we certainly agree with you that we would like to write our own rules and write them clearly and precisely so that there's no opportunity for challenge by the clever lawyers. And therefore, we have been embarking with the Department of Health to get this amendment bill through Parliament. We were interrupted again by the elections, etc., but we would like to restate that process with this committee support and with a lot of vigorous support from the department as well to be able to implement those rules, change the legislation as we would like to have been done. In relation to the more technical questions around ICD-10 coding and capitation models, I'll defer to our colleagues here. Thank you.
See, I think on the DRGs and the capitation, probably best able to respond. Just to bring committee members into the picture of what we're talking about, you mentioned earlier when you go to a hospital and then they bill you for a swab and a syringe, etc. And that system is referred to as a fee-for-service model. And in that model, the risk is always, in order for you to make enough money out of the patient, you have to service them sufficiently. The less you do to the patient, the less you can charge. And so in order to remove that risk, many reimbursement systems across the world have moved towards what the Honourable Member was talking about what we talk about capitation systems, to say, in order to do a particular medical procedure, this is all the equipment, consumables, and drugs you need, this is how much it's going to cost. That requires quite a lot of technical complexity to do. And so in the NHI environment, we will certainly want to do that. And the Honourable Member is correct that it's quite a complex process and takes a lot of time. So what we have done in preparation for the NHI process is to identify in the central hospitals 80% of the procedures that are done on a regular basis. We are costing that, which means that we go in with a stopwatch and says how much of time it takes for a doctor, what equipment does he use in order to do that procedure, and then calculate that and say, okay, if you want to do a cesarean section, this is how much it's going to cost us. Doctor's time, drugs, equipment, etc., etc. We're then going to reimburse the hospital. The NHI would reimburse a hospital, the public sector central hospital, for example, for that procedure based on that calculation. And so over time, we will then expand that from central to tertiary to regional, district, etc., slowly, because you're absolutely right that it's very complex and it will take a long time to actually do. But it will get away from this behavior thing. Because somebody is in front of you that you need to overserve them, I usually say to the doctors, it's not a good idea for you to say to your patient, get well, because if you did, your fee-for-service model falls flat, you'd never be able to earn any money, because why would the patient come back to you? And so the capitation model tries to encourage you to actually treat the patient to make sure he or she is resolved as a result of that. I just want to also comment here on this issue about the PMBs. The PMBs are affordable, but in the PMB legislation it states that when a PMB condition is identified and the provider generates a bill, the medical scheme must pay for the bill in full. And because there's no control on what a person can charge, you can charge whatever you like because the Medicaid must pay it in full. And so the PMBs have become unaffordable. Because if you take the same PMBs and ask what does the public sector pay for those services, it's about eighth of the price of what you're paying in the private market. But that's simply because people can charge what they like, and so they do. And so I think the regulatory system becomes critical for that.
You also want to respond? Yes, please. I totally agree with Dr. Pillay's on the PMBs. It's not about not affordable. The trend for us is a concern, and it's all about payment in full. So the trend is really a concern. On managed care, it's not that managed care is not offering value. We must make sure that our beneficiaries get value, and we need to maximize that process. I think if you take away the managed care principles today, then probably the private healthcare system could collapse. I'm talking like a hospital or authorization. Maybe it is simple, but just take away that authorization process and see what is going to happen with our patients in the industry. But we as council, together with the Department of Health, we need to look at our processes in data collection and make sure to collect relevant data so that we can monitor the process over time and make sure that our beneficiaries get value for money and that is improvement in the system and quality of care. Just a comment on the outcomes. The question from the DA, yes, it is a lot of work. It's not going to be overnight. The outcomes are very complicated, but we need to make a start. And we started at the Council for Medical Scheme working together with the industry. There's a so-called IDAP project, Industry Technical Advisory Panel, where we work with the experts from the industry where they are helping us to find the outcomes. South Africa, outcomes is really relevant. It is a new process indicators, yes, that we can get to a certain extent, but outcomes is really new. But we must put processes in place that we collect the relevant data to measure that. The challenge is in terms of the data. your test results, you will find a lot of the test results is sitting in text fields. You cannot do analysis with information sitting in text fields. So we've got really a mammoth task to help the industry to transform that. But we're going to do it, and we're going to need more resources to help us to do it.
Honorable, thank you very much. And I think we've tried to make our presentation as clear as possible to the Honorable Committee. And I think I've already apologized to our body language. I think we needed to make some assumptions as the delegates of CMS, because we needed to assume that some of the things you probably know, because if you had not done that and went into the basic presentation, we are risking undermining you, and then that was our approach. But we appreciate the fact that at the end of it, we fought each other. I think at the initial stage, the process engineers derailed us, but I think ultimately we fought each other. I think later this year, we'll be coming back to present our annual report, which report will detail the results of our operation for the financial year that ended March 2014. And I think, like we've indicated, early in the next year, we'll be coming here to present the budget and the strategic plan for the people report. I think the process issue, we need to just make sure that it's in order, so that we come early in the year, so that the differences of timing do not create unnecessary debates at the beginning of the process. But we're very thankful that we've made this presentation, and I think we appreciate the comments that you look into the amendment bill, because I think this has been also going on for a long time. Even the previous administration had dealt with this matter, but I think this new administration, I think it will process that to the end. We will move forward. Thank you very much, Chair.
It's been a fine word from the Council. I think, firstly, we want to just thank you for taking time out to read the document. That's what became very clear by virtue of the questions. We know that takes time, so we thank you for your consideration, and we also thank you for the questions that you've put to us. These interactions are always very, very important, and this, in fact, has been a significant meeting, because there's a new committee. This Council has a proud tradition of working with the Portfolio Committee. They have a proud tradition of, in fact, never having a qualified audit report, and that is something that is not up for negotiation. And we will work squarely within the parameters of the PFMA and Treasury regulation. Please be rest assured on that. And so far as the process issues are concerned, you're not asking us to do anything extra, because we're bound to do that anyway. And we are just absolutely happy to comply with that aspect. And so really, just from our point of view, thank you for having us here this afternoon, and we're willing to come out any time that you so require, so that we can work in the best interests of what is a very, very complicated industry. We just want to say thank you very much.
I think on behalf of the committee, let us thank you, but first I want to raise something there. You attended the presentation, your staff leave much to be desired. I hope when you come back and the department is looking into this, that you do some a major makeover. I wanted to raise that. I see you want to respond on that before I...
That point is well taken. I think it's just the composition of this particular delegation. In terms of our gender equity, in terms of our staff, members of council, all of those things, we're shining bright.
We want you to understand that we were just on the verge of giving the marching orders. Because we know that we can do that, but it's only that we are reasonable. We know that we have got a responsibility of ensuring that entities that are falling
under the authority and jurisdiction of Department of Health knows their, they know their story, and they are doing things in a manner that is going to assist the department. Remember that health is an apex priority, and therefore, us reading the document is quite a thing that it's our second life. Complicated as some of the presentations are. So feel free. There will be those times, they usually say difficult times and moments always produce a very good and outcome. We will give you marching orders at some point if we pick up that you are not doing your work as you are supposed to do. I said initially, all of us in this community are health activists. That you must understand. What is key for us, it's what is affecting our ordinary people on the ground, irrespective of color, creed, and gender, irrespective of whatever. You hear that there will be those challenges that will be coming even from ourselves. So we hope that you have noted the areas where we had some, the process areas where we have some serious concerns. We hope we'll come when you come back. We will still decide, guided by the committee section, if we want you to come back and look into some of the things. We are not going to wait for your financial year, just making an example, but rest assured that we have taken a decision as the ANC government that this year, this administration, which we want to have a radical transformation in this transition, we are not going to miss our word. And we're not going to be apologetic about that. Obviously, we won't be hostile. Obviously, we won't create we won't be arrogant. We won't create a hostile environment. But we'll always be vigilant. So, rest assured, we're not angry. We're not cross with you. But we just, ourselves also, we wanted to check that if you are not taken, I don't want to say, I don't mean that you've been taking us for granted. But knowing very well that I'm sure when you came in here, you could see that, gosh, these are new faces. And what is this? Thank you very much. And until we meet again. And I saw when you came in, you're familiar with health. When you came in, you served yourself. And I looked at, oh, okay. So they are part of the family, of the portfolio, of portfolio control here. Thank you very much. We will, it's not that we're chasing you, we've still got a committee work to do, but travel safely. Thank you. Can I offer you tea as you go out because we are also under pressure of time. Whilst they are preparing to go out, I'm often saying that we've all got copies of the minutes of the last ones I'm talking about to delay.
I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, honorable members. Let me close the door. Honorable members, we have been provided with the minutes of the portfolio committee of the 9th of July, which took place in room V119. And the agenda was adoption of the committee's budget code reports and minutes. If we are all in position of those, of those, can we start? Somebody who is disadvantaged who wants to quickly go and change his phone. It's just one page, one below.
page 1, any comments on page 1? I'll go on page 2. Last page, and comment any challenging concern. Can we, is there any corrections and additions and concerns? Can we get a mover?
I move for the adoption of the minutes as a true reflection of the previous meeting.
Okay. Dr. Mazara, second the movement.
As the refugee caucus in the news, the time was against you. Just to correct, you say I, Honorable Soso from Zelda's head. If you can start.
No, that's fine. I, Honorable Mosala, move for the adoption of the minister to reflection of the deliberations that took place in the previous meeting. Thank you.
Honorable Chairman, I was going to second it, but I think I'll try to third.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Honorable Members, for patience, and I do think that we are going to do well in this committee. That entities can pick up that in fact we are not talking about things that we don't know, and it refers to that we have read our documents. I think it's a good start. I hope we can continue doing that. It's last time. We're going home. We're going to go and do our constituency work as a portfolio of health. Let's communicate. Even the opposition parties, let's communicate. At the end, we are to do this together. We are to do all this together. We may have our own ideological and political views at the end. We are charged with the responsibility of assisting this administration on how then do we change the social conditions for our people in the sector of health. Enjoy your 1 week for now. I would say 1 week for now. Enjoy it. Come back full speed. It's still going to be a marathon. Honorable Chair.
I was going to say thank you for your leadership, Madam Chair. And also to say that we do come from different political orientations, but we have a health issue to deal with in our country in everybody's interest. And so that's sort of our approach, and to say that everybody must take care of their constituencies, and we'll see you when you all return. Thank you.